You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of March, 2017, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now.
But not in the way Trump might have hoped. We'll be discussing how one of the president's main campaign promises for healthcare has become a major headache. My guests, Zenya Wickett and Isabel Hilton, will be discussing this and the other day's top stories, including Hong Kong as a new leader. We'll be finding out who Carrie Lam is and what her influence will be. We'll also learn what sparked protests across Russia this weekend and ask whether airlines should be able to enforce a dress code on their passengers. Well, that's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Zenya Wickett, head of the US and the Americas program at Chatham House, and Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Welcome both to the program. Now, one of the few consistent policy lines that Donald Trump stuck to during last year's presidential campaign was his ambition to repeal the disaster, as he put it, that is Obamacare. But on Friday, support for Trump's replacement healthcare plan appeared to crumble among Washington Republicans. He and House Speaker Paul Ryan were forced to withdraw the policy. Zenya, what happened here? We know kind of what happened, but what was the failure? Was it a failure to be able to lobby and sell to Republicans?
So, I mean, let me start with something. This wasn't Trump's healthcare bill. It's not clear that Trump really cared terribly much about reforming healthcare. I think if Trump had had his choice, he would have gone straight to working on taxation, a taxation plan, new tax plan, and infrastructure. But the reality is that for 7 years, the Republicans in Congress pushed back against Obamacare. And so now that they control the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they needed to do something about that, move forward on that agenda. And that therein lied the problem. The Republicans in Congress are split into two factions, the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Partiers, and what I'm calling the mainstream Republicans. And then the White House is held by a third faction, Trump. Trump doesn't have much support on Congress. Neither of those two factions have much support in the White House. And so what happened, what came to kind of culminated on Friday, was one faction, the Tea Partiers, saying, we need to completely blow it up, completely remove Obamacare. The moderate middle of the Republican Party saying, well, actually, it includes insurance for a whole load of our constituents that want to keep insurance. And Trump essentially trying for the first time to get something through a legislative agenda and not really having a clue how to go about doing it. And so the whole thing blew up. Trump tried to put a certain amount of pressure because he didn't want to lose anything. And the Republicans in Congress said, sorry, no, we can actually stand up to you. And your threats to enact revenge don't actually scare us. And so this is the first moment, and this is where I'll end. This is the first moment where Trump is discovering that his threats aren't necessarily going to succeed in Congress, aren't going to have the impact that he wants them to have. That is going to be hugely damaging for his own kind of sense of what he can get done, because he doesn't have the people and he doesn't have the experience to know how to get things through Congress. So this is, it means something for the healthcare bill, but it means something else for the legislative agenda that we have yet to see.
So if you're going to apportion percentage blame, how much would go to naivety, not knowing how the system works? How much goes to Trump not being able to master the intricacies of this policy? How much goes to the fact that it's just so split he will never be able to do good deals?
So I don't actually think you can apportion blame in the sense of 30% to this person, 30% to that person. The people who are most responsible are the Tea Partiers, who have no interest in compromise, So the people who just want to get rid of it, lock, stock and barrel, without any interest in the implications. Trump, who doesn't have a clue at the moment, and his administration doesn't have a clue to how to get things through the legislative agenda, and who didn't care about the detail, clearly didn't care about the detail. And of course, the moderates, are they to blame? Yes, in the sense that, you know, Paul Ryan is unable to bring the factions of the Republican Party together. And the Democrats just sat back and watched it happen.
Now, Isabel, I think many people, when they saw, you know, this storming victory, well, kind of storming, the victory anyway for Trump that allowed him to have both Senate and Congress, many people who were maybe in a European context, for example, they imagined it would be like a, you know, winning, you know, the House of Commons, for example, or, you know, the French Parliament, that once you had that number of seats, everything would tick along nicely. It doesn't work like that, does it? And does this mean that actually for people who are opposed to what Donald Trump's doing, there's more hope in the future that lots of the things that he promised are going to come asunder?
I think it could work better than it is working at the moment. But for all the reasons we just heard about, I mean, this is a staggeringly incompetent presidency with absolutely no experience and kind of childlike view of the complications of governing. I mean, the idea that you can simply translate business into government, as they've discovered with this very bruising experience, doesn't work. It seems to me, looking going forward, that very little has been learned. I mean, Trump so far has blamed the Democrats, Paul Ryan, and the right wing of the Republican Party, and said, well, I never really, and denied that he said he'd reform healthcare quickly. So, I mean, we've seen the kind of the Trump playbook. He's now talking about tax reform with the notion that Republicans are totally behind tax reform, so that'll be easy. But actually, if you start to look at the granular detail of Republicans on tax reform, you see pretty much the same spectrum. You see people who want, you know, a radical agenda. You see people who are not happy with increasing the deficit. You see people who want a border tax adjustment. You see people who want more moderate reform. You know, he's not really going to have any easier a time on that. And unless he's prepared, you know, to sit down and master some detail and understand the complexities of negotiation with his own party, he's not going to be able to do very well on that one either. And I think what this has taught us, and taught the people who perhaps will gain hope from this, is that the Republicans, having been in opposition for all these years, and a particularly unhelpful opposition that simply had the luxury of sitting there saying no and refusing to cooperate, they are not fit for government. And they're not fit for government without a pretty good leader to unite them. And right now they don't have one. Ryan has been exposed as unable to do the job, and Trump clearly can't. He's alienated too many people.
Zenia.
So I just wanted to pick up a little bit on your question as well, which is, I mean, I think what we should take away from this, we knew, frankly, the moment the results came in on November 8, 9, which is the Republican Party is three factions. We should consider them three parties. Trump, Tea Partiers, moderate middle. They are effectively Tea Parties and three parties, and they have very distinct interests, and they have an unwillingness in some respects to compromise. And so I think, to your question, the message absolutely is it's going to be very, very hard to get anything through through Congress in this administration, despite the fact that the Republicans hold the presidency, the House and the Senate. Is that a good thing? Well, on the one hand, you can say, you know what, maybe we didn't particularly like what Trump stands for and what he wants to get done. So it's a good thing that lots of those things aren't going to happen. Absolutely. It's also a bad thing because it means that nothing is going to happen. If you thought that America was dysfunctional under the Obama administration, we're going to take it to a whole new level. And that has both pros and cons. Now, a possible positive outcome, if you want to be an optimist, and I personally think this is extremely unlikely, is that Paul Ryan eventually realizes he can't work with the Tea Party, very conservative Republicans. And he says, you know what, but maybe I can work with the Democrats. And you can actually see, because actually in some issues, the Democrats, like infrastructure, the Democrats and the moderate Republicans are actually quite closely aligned. So you can actually see progress being made in that space. But it would actually take Paul Ryan saying, I'm going to give up on one faction of my party. And I think that it's going to be a while before he does that. The only other thing I wanted to mention is, do not for a moment think that the problem is only on the Republican side. The Democrats, right now we don't see their splits because they're quite happily sitting back, putting their feet up and just watching the Republicans eviscerate themselves. The Democrats are also very split. And at some point, the Democrats are going to have to figure out how to bring together the Bernie Sanders faction with the Clinton faction. That is going to be equally difficult.
But it's fascinating. The two big moves, you know, the Muslim ban or the migration thing went awry. Now, this has gone horribly wrong. On the issue of taxation, if he was going to turn to the Democrats and to the more moderate Republicans, what happens to people who sit in you know, as his advisors, like Bannon, who are more looking to the right? Does his actually, who's in the White House, become dysfunctional then?
But that's why I say it's not going to happen. The chances of Paul Ryan, because that's who would have to do it effectively. Paul Ryan actually standing up and saying, you know what? There's this whole faction of my party and I'm going to give up on them and I'm going to work with the Democrats instead. I mean, the implosion you would have there, I just don't see that happening. It's not credible. Would Trump reach out to the Democrats? Yeah. I mean, he's already made some signs that he is willing to reach out to the Democrats and would. Are the Democrats going to actually partner with Donald Trump?
Not easily.
After what's happened over the last few months, I just don't see that happening.
And Isabel, we just had this other news that, you know, Jared Kushner is going to be appointed to run government like business. Now, this is a prime example of trying to run government like business, and it goes horribly wrong.
Yes, it certainly did. And the other person who got a bit of a sideswipe was indeed the very Jared Kushner who was skiing when the health care bill went belly up. So he hasn't demonstrated a, you know, total commitment. His wife has also got an office in the West Wing and security clearance. So we have these two unelected characters now, you know, taking a fairly central role. Well, I mean, I think this is, you know, they are certainly Trump's security blanket, but whether they will have an effect on making government any more consequent, I would doubt. The one thing it seems to me that Trump can do without supporting Congress and without any coherence to his government is to undo all that list of things that Obama had to enact through executive orders because he couldn't get things through Congress. And there is an impression this week that another bit of Trump distraction will be to sign the executive order, which cancels the clean air executive order from Obama, which is part of the dismantling of the climate agenda, which will go ahead because it doesn't require any congressional action. And so what's left Trump is a series of negative moves. But I think in terms of advancing his agenda, with Kushner or not, I think it's going to stay stuck.
Just before we move on, Zenia, has anyone in this administration risen to the top? Because lots of people are actually, I was reading the comments today about Jared Kushner, lots of people in business in Silicon Valley saying, actually, here's a bit of a hopeful sign. At least, you know, he seems to understand what we're doing. You know, even if it's not, you know, able to run government as business, we kind of like him in a way. Is there anyone who's come out of this administration you think, oh, actually, here's somebody who's going to prove to be a great politician?
A great politician, I don't know. But I think we need to be careful. I mean, I think that there's an awful lot of people who take the election campaign and take the rough edges that is Donald Trump, to say it diplomatically, and dismiss everything as a result. And I think we actually need to be able to get beyond kind of partisan attitudes and actually a little bit more open-eyed actually take a look at it. If you look at the administration, for example, Jim Mattis as Secretary of Defense, H.R. McMaster's as National Security Advisor, Allen at Homeland Security. I mean, all military officers, but they've all got enormous experience and hugely respected in the foreign policy domain. Tillerson at the State Department. I mean, there's huge critiques about Tillerson right now in the media about just being weak-willed and just not knowing what's going on. But frankly, if you were to take the job at the head of an organization where you admittedly know almost nothing about what the agenda is, you have no idea about how the system, the processes work. If you're smart, you keep your head down, you keep your mouth shut until you've got some people around you that you can trust, you have a sense of your agenda, you have a sense of how it works, and then you go out and engage. And so, while I can, as somebody who used to work in the State Department, I can look at Tillerson and say, wow, I really wish he'd stand up for the State Department and stop being such, you know, a weak-willed, lily-livered, I can keep going. If he's actually a smart businessman, he's doing exactly what he's doing. Now, I'm not sure that he's that calculated. I'm not sure that's why he is taking a lesser position. But I think we have to just be a little careful before we dismiss out of hand the whole administration. You know, you can imagine infrastructure. There's an agenda item that Democrats and Republicans want to make progress on. We can all agree that we ought to be doing something on infrastructure. How they do it, public-private partnerships, how they are structured, where investment goes first, I think that that's all in question and we need to see the details. Tax reform, we can all agree that that's something that, you know, simplifying the tax code is something that we should be doing. So I think I just caution people to, you know, to specific, and then I'll end with this, you know, specific Jared Kushner's office on American entrepreneurship, American innovation. On the one hand, please. On the other hand, actually, making government a little bit more efficient. I think we can all agree that would probably be a good thing. So I'm skeptical. I need to see more. As far as I've seen, there's way too much dreaming, but I'm not willing to condemn it until I see what happens.
Well, we're going to leave that story for a moment. I think we've done for the Trump administration for the last 15 minutes. We're going to move on to Hong Kong because Hong Kong has a new chief executive leader, Carrie Lam. She became the first woman elected to the position over the weekend. She has vowed to heal divisions within the region over demands from Hong Kongers for increased democratic rights. But she immediately began her tenure amid a renewed crackdown on pro-democracy lawmakers. Isabel, when anyone says they're going to kind of heal the wounds, it normally means they're going to tell. It normally means that one group is going to be told to shut up and put up.
That's been our recent experience.
Carrie Lam, is it all just good news for Beijing and bad news for people who support democracy?
I think it's disappointing news for those who support democracy. There was some thought that she wouldn't, you know, have a completely clear run, although, of course, the system is rigged. But she had been a pretty well-respected civil servant. She was number two to a very, very unpopular outgoing chief executive. And that really is what ditched her reputation. It was her support for him and indeed taking a very hard line on the umbrella protests and this very increasingly bitter debate about Hong Kong's political future, where she is firmly on the Beijing side. Now, having had this endorsement, she could take a different line from CY Leung, and that would be very welcome. But it would require her, I think, to make concessions to the pan-democrats. It would require her to be accommodating to the thought that democracy in Hong Kong might include universal suffrage, might include being able to vote on a list that isn't handpicked by Beijing. So essentially you're getting a choice, you know, between a set of Beijing-approved candidates. And I think that if she doesn't do that, then the frustration that we see increasingly amongst the young who are becoming, you know, less and less moderate and constrained is simply going to build, and we should expect more overt resistance and more trouble.
And tell me, the crackdown today, is that just coincidence, do you think, or this was deliberately timed to kind of show that she's going to be a tough new hand?
I think she wanted to be a tough new hand. I mean, of course, the cases have been going on. I mean, these are people who, you know, who were part of the protests that have been going on for the last couple of years. But again, you know, it was a strong signal that, perhaps a signal to Beijing that she's not going to be a pushover, but also a signal to particularly these, you know, the student protesters that she's not a pushover. So we'll see. I think that's all right, as long as she opens the door a bit to the pan-democrats and the seasoned opposition who have been campaigning quietly and constitutionally for what, after all, Beijing signed up to when it agreed the handover with the UK.
So you just tell me, for any kind of global capital looking at Hong Kong, nobody seems to want to get involved, do they, in this kind of debate? Even the Brits, you know, yes, we support the rights of Hong Kongers, and we'd like to see people, you know, stick by the agreement we have with the Chinese. But actually, you know, lots of people want to push back against China in many places. But when it comes to Hong Kong, nobody seems to really want to get involved.
I think there's a real, I mean, you know, I'm now going to kind of move to 40,000 foot thinking, which is there's a real kind of pervasive sense of insecurity in the West at the moment. And it's partly, and this predates Trump, it predates populism. It in some respects goes back to the recession, started 2007-08. But there's a real sense, and it even predates that to some extent, the kind of internal focus in Europe of holding together the EU and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a real sense of kind of insecurity in the West, and I'm using this terminology very broadly. And equally, there's a stronger sense of Chinese strength in some respects post the recession, where we all came to look for China as the driver of economic growth rather than the West, that I think has led a number to, in some respects, back off. I mean, certainly the sentiment when I talk to Europeans about China, they kind of say, we have no leverage. When we're talking about territorial issues, not so much Hong Kong, but when you're talking about South or East China Sea, they just say, we have no leverage. We need the Chinese economy to drive our own economy, and we have no leverage. And the Americans, I mean, it's going to be very interesting. Isabel and I were talking before this about the Trump-Xi meeting in April. It's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, Trump was utterly, I'm about to say abusive, and that probably is the right word towards China throughout the campaign. And yet, the sense of many, including myself, is that you're going to hear a very different Trump coming out of the meeting with Xi. Is America feeling strong, or is China feeling strong? I will hasten to add, by the way, that that sense of weakness and sense of strength doesn't necessarily have any reflection in reality. Yet it is a sense, and I think that is affecting how...
I absolutely agree it's a sense, but I think that there's a time lag here. China's economic target is currently 6.5%. Mm-hmm. It's probably around 4% real growth. China isn't going to drive the global economy in the way that it did.
Exactly.
And it's, every economist you talk to who looks at China... It talks about when the crisis is coming, not if the crisis is coming. China's also at a moment when it's bidding for a kind of moral authority that goes with global leadership, and Trump has opened that door. Yeah. So actually, this is a moment when one could say to China, particularly if you're Britain and you're a signatory to the treaty, if you want to demonstrate, moral authority, take a reasonable line on Hong Kong.
Yeah.
It would actually do them tremendous good.
Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck and Xenia Wickett and Isabel Hilton. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about why Russians are taking to the streets and also leggings.
What is culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows. There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fist fights, and everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, we're not enjoying the after party. We're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
You're listening to Midori House, and still with me are Xenia Wickett and Isabel Hilton. Now, this weekend saw protests unfold in Moscow and other Russian cities to demonstrate against Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. Well, the rallies were led by anti-corruption campaigner Alexei Navalny, who claims Medvedev has amassed mansions, vineyards and yachts during his time in office. Thousands took to the streets, with 850 protesters reportedly apprehended by Moscow authorities alone. Isabel, how dangerous is this? What's happening?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's not directly dangerous for Putin, except that it's quite a smart approach by the opposition. They're not attacking Putin directly. They are, as you say, attacking Medvedev, and they're attacking corruption, which is always a potent rallying cry in an economy that's not doing particularly well. So, it puts Putin in a difficult position. Of course, Putin, is surrounded by deeply corrupt figures, has himself, amassed a fortune. But by attacking someone who could, in theory, be got rid of. They're not going directly for a man who retains his personal popularity outside Moscow and outside the big cities.
Zenia, do you think this is merely about yours? And what's interesting is several thousand people probably did demonstrate in Moscow alone. But when you look at the numbers who didn't demonstrate,
yeah,
is it important as a sign of protest?
I think that, I mean, you know, go back to the protests, I think it was 2011-12-ish, that really, where people really did come out, not just in Moscow, but across the country, and take a look at the impact, the long-term impact that's had. Zero. And at least... maybe not zero, but certainly close to it in terms of, has it changed the system in Russia? No.
Well,
has it changed the leadership
worse in the short term?
In Russia, exactly. And so you look at this and you say, you know, on the one hand, incredibly brave for people to come out and protest. And there are some severe implications with that for them personally. Is it going to change the system in any way? No, it's unlikely to. You know, if the protests were particularly large, the most likely scenario is that Putin would get rid of Medvedev, you know, arrest him, et cetera, et cetera. That would be the fall guy. And, you know, the system would go on. This was a protest against corruption. That is a very big issue, not just in Russia, but elsewhere, particularly given the economic situation, the downturn over the last couple of years, principally since the sanctions came to pass. You know, but is this going to make any long-term difference? No. Is Russia going to become a less corrupt place because of this? No. I mean, it's actually quite depressing in a sense.
I wouldn't be quite as depressed as that, because I think that there's a high... I do think there's a high symbolic value. If you look what's happened since since the protests of 2011, there has been increased repression, a closing down of civil society, mass arrests, and indeed selective murders. So the fact that people will still come out on the streets and will rally to a cause like this and will defend, you know, a man they regard as a symbolic figure, you know, Alexei Navalny, the opposition figure, I think just gives a signal to the rest of Russia that there is another way and that there is still hope. And you never know what's going to happen with these things.
Well, we have 45 seconds to put to rights one of the biggest issues of the day. Should women be allowed to wear leggings only? Well, tops, I presume, as well, on a United Airlines flight. United Airlines told a group of women that they were not allowed to board wearing just leggings. It turns out they were pass riders, which means you probably have a relative working for the airline, and they have strict controls.
They weren't even women. They were little girls. You know, this is completely an own goal by a particularly obnoxious airline that seems to have dress codes that only apply to its female passengers. The father of one of these children was wearing shorts.
Yes.
How is that a business-appropriate dress code?
Yeah.
I'm with Isabel. Every now and then you read something and you just kind of go, really? You really did that? You really? And then you made it worse by kind of going out, no, stop. They should have stopped.
I have got on a plane, though, back from some holiday destinations where people do still rock up in kind of like sand-covered swimwear. And they want to get on the plane in, like, you know, bikini tops.
Those are passengers. You know, what can you say? But this is absurd. Leggings are not sand-covered swimwear.
And let's face it,
I'm wearing them now. There's nothing wrong with them.
And we allowed you in the studio.
In the studio. Yeah.
I did say to Tom to check carefully what everyone was wearing today before they were.
The Midori House dress code.
Well, apparently there's been a kind of a whole outpouring online with famous celebrities kind of posting pictures of themselves wearing leggings.
I want every passenger to turn up in leggings.
In leggings, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I have been sent a picture of William Shatner in leggings as well, if you'd like to see
that. Yes, it's particularly fetching, that one.
No, but that's my point. I mean, seriously, you know, we could all take a look at people and kind of go, really? You're wearing that in public? Truly? Leggings really aren't that bad.
I don't know why you're looking at me, but anyway, yes. Zenia Wicket, Isabel Hilton, thank you very much for joining us on today's Midori House, because that's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Naomi Joseph. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. He's very well dressed. Anyway, there's more music next. And at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Robert Bound, of course. And we're going to have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours London time. Midori House, well, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.